So I'm going to ask a question. You know, I often start with a question I kind of know the answer to, but I think I may know the answer to this one. Have you ever been doing something that was really difficult and you were wearing through it and you're kind of like, you know, I just want to get this done. I'm going on. I'm trying to do it. And I see the finish line ahead. If I can just get to that point, everything will be good. And you get to that point, and it turns out there's still more. You thought you were set. You thought you pushed far enough. You thought you'd be well by now. You thought things would have come together by now. You thought that relationship would have healed by now. And there's still more work to do. Where we all experience these things. You know, you could even be doing things you enjoy and experience that. You know, I used to hike quite a bit through the White Mountains. And one trip a friend of mine and I took, it's what they call the Presidential Traverse. It's where you take over 3 days. You go through the Presidential Range. You kind of go over the mountains as you go. You know, on that first day, you feel pretty good. You know, but you're packing everything with you. Now you're packing light. You got a light tent and so forth. And on the first day, your pack feels pretty light. By the third day and about five summits behind you, you thought someone put some rocks in your bag or something, because somehow it is much heavier than it used to be. You know, and I remember that as we were kind of on that last day, we still had two more summits to go. And so we're at the next to the last summit, we're on the trail, or actually said next to the last mountain, we're on the trail to summit that mountain. And you kind of look up and you see the summit, and you know, on the first day you're like really up, on the last day you're like, just, you know, head down, glance up once in a while. There it is. And I remember on that next to the last mountain, we finally got up. We came over the edge of the summit, and it's what they call a false summit. It's the shoulder of the mountain. It's just where you are on the trail, you can't see the actual summit. So you thought you were there, and there's still a couple hundred feet to go. You know, and in that moment, you kind of have these feelings of, you know, there's a shortcut back to the car. You know, I'm just kind of doing this because I want to. I don't have to do these last two. But where would that have gotten me? You know, I put in all this time already. And that was just for fun. But, you know, accomplishments that are for fun are still valuable. And I think that's something that we all deal with in these difficult times, is that when we've pushed ourselves as far as we can, and there's still more, we wish we could turn back. Now, in my case, I could have walked back to the car. But oftentimes in life, we don't have that option. Our option is either to just let something completely fail. Sometimes we don't have any options. We have to keep carrying on. And so as we've been in this series these past few weeks that we're wrapping up today, that we call Beat the Odds, Facts, Faith, and Focus, what we've been looking at is these kind of principles that we can apply in getting through difficult times. Right, that when we're in a difficult situation, that, you know, I find that these three things, if we will embrace these three ideas, it can carry us through. You know, the first one seems kind of strange, embrace the facts. But the reality is that when things are difficult, there's a huge temptation to kind of lie to ourselves. That there are things that are really hard, I'll just pretend they're not there, which doesn't really work out. Right, but at the same time, we don't want to make things seem harder than they are. Oh, why even try? I'll never get through it. But we want to look at the reality of it. Right, that we lean on our faith, that we recognize there are some things we cannot control. We turn those things over to God. But at the same time, we stay in connection with God. We pray. Ideally, we engage with His Word. We look for His direction. And sometimes we can be tempted to stop there. Well, I've prayed, it must be good. But that doesn't seem to be how God does things. Because God calls us to work really hard at the things we're doing. So we need to focus on doing all that we can. A classic principle is that you pray like it all depends on God, and you work like it all depends on you. And that's how it seems to be how God brings us through difficult situations. So now, as we've been in this series, we've been walking through the story of Esther. Now, I'm just going to give a really quick review of Esther. If you've missed the earlier messages, I encourage you to go check them out. But just really quickly, right, Esther was a person who had experienced incredible challenges in her life. Over and over again, increasingly difficult. The stakes kept getting higher and higher. And she prevails, and if we read closely, it's by following these principles. Now, remember that Esther was an orphan, in the conquered nation of Israel under the rule of the Persian Empire, that she somehow rose up, and under really unlikely circumstances, rose up to become queen of Persia. Now, it's not a political role, but she certainly had access. She had influence. And as she rose into that position, it appears that she helps her cousin Mordecai out, because Mordecai was the guy who raised her when she was a child. And after she becomes queen, Mordecai is now a palace official. So if we go through our narrative, basically Mordecai and Esther are our heroes, but we have a villain. Who's our villain? Haman. It's funny, if you were Jewish, I used to work with some Jewish people. If you tell the story of Esther, every time you say Haman, you go, which is kind of funny the first time you experience it. And so Haman's the bad guy, right? And Haman basically becomes angry at Mordecai. And we learn that Haman's a racist. And so Haman's solution to being angry at Mordecai is to wipe out everyone who's the same race as he is, to wipe out all the Jewish people. Now, what Haman does is that he deceptively gets the king's permission to do this. He tells the king that there's this group of people out there, this strange group of people who live differently than you do, who believe differently than you do, and they're a threat to your kingdom. Never quite explains how they're a threat, but they're different, so they must be a threat. And Haman never identifies what group of people that is, but he gets the king's permission to literally put out a kill order for that entire group of people. That on a date about a year in the future, everyone who's in the empire would have the right to kill those people and take their property. Now, as we saw last week, that Esther found herself in a very unenviable situation. That she realizes that all this has come together, that her people's lives are at risk, and someone needs to get to the king to try to get this stopped. And she realizes that she's the only one who's got a chance of doing that. Accessing the king is incredibly difficult, right? Even for her, it's incredibly difficult. In fact, what was the rule if you went to visit the king and he didn't invite you? Oh, come on, you all wish you could do this, right? Yeah. If he come and visit you without being invited, you're killed. The assumption was if you went to the king without being invited, you must intend him harm. And that included the queen. So Esther had to make the decision to risk her life, to try to get to the king, have him find her favorable, so she could tell him what was going on. And she did. She did all that. And she worked this incredible plan we went through last week. And she actually gets the king to understand what Haman is doing. And the king gets rid of Haman. And so Esther's last request, as we kind of finished up last week, was, okay, now that Haman's gone, king, can you please pull back the kill order? And what do we learn? Right, was that as Haman had put that order out, he did it in the king's name with the king's permission, sealed with the official seal, and any message or command that goes out like that cannot be revoked. And that's where we left Esther last week. Now think about all Esther has been through over these past 3 weeks previous to this. When she got to that point, she thought that all I need to do is just get rid of Haman, we'll get rid of that order, my people will be okay. And there's still more to do now. And she has to be close to being exhausted. She must have been just about all that she's been through, all she could face. So she finds herself here. She recognizes something that I would encourage all of us to keep our hearts and minds open to. Oftentimes, the difficult journeys in our life are ours to make on our own. That there are periods in our life where we just kind of got to get through what we're getting through, right? Like if you're ill, you're being treated for a serious illness, people can love you as much as they do, but you're kind of in that journey on your own. And that can happen to us in many places in life. But at some point when we're doing things, we should really look for the chance to bring in help. I mean, again, if you're really sick, you go to the doctor sort of thing, but often if you're kind of called to a particular ministry and you're trying to serve a group of people and no one else would come along, so you just kept doing it, well, keep asking for help from people you trust, people you can lean on. True in our work, true in our relationship stuff, that maybe you're struggling through a relationship situation. And you just can't get through it. You know, bring in a counselor. Right? Be willing to bring in other help. And what Esther figures out or becomes to understand is that as she reaches this point where Haman is now gone and the kill order is still out there, she needs help. And so she brings in help, ultimately it will be from Mordecai. Here's what the narrative tells us. So at this point, as we pick up the narrative, that Haman has just been taken away. So the king knows what's going on. He knows that Esther and her people were being threatened. Their lives were being threatened. Haman was behind it. Haman's gone. That has all just happened. So now as we jump into the narrative, it says, on that same day, King Xerxes gave the property of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. So first of all, what the king is trying to do is basically say, I'm sorry, right? That he's trying to provide restoration. That this stuff was going on. I didn't know it was going on. I didn't know it affected you. So to try to make you, I don't know, make you whole, but to at least apologize, I'm going to give you Haman's resources. And we learned early on that Haman's resources were substantial. And then it says, then Mordecai was brought before the king, for Esther had told the king how they were related. Now, why is it important that she bring Mordecai in at this point? Esther is clearly an incredibly intelligent person, incredibly resourceful, but she now has access to loads and loads of, we'll call it money. And there's a situation here that requires really strong political moves. And just because of her life experiences, she would not have known how to, or even understood how to manage resources of that scale. And she's never been trained in how to deal with the political environment. But Mordecai has actually worked in that, likely for years at this point. So Mordecai understands how to work in this environment. So what she's done is she said that, okay, I've carried this as far as I can. To continue this on, I need to bring in this person, Mordecai, who I trust dearly. Because remember that Mordecai is the one who raised her, who's cared for her, cared about her. I'm going to bring him in. And remember that Mordecai is a very trusted official, that he already works for the king. And the king really likes him for another reason. Remember what it was? He saved his life. Remember that there was a murder plot against the king, and Mordecai actually risked his own life to get that information to the king so the king didn't die. So, you know, someone saves your life, is a loyal, you know, a loyal employee, and you probably feel pretty good about him. And he also learns that this same man that you already respect is the person who cared for Esther when she was young, helped her to grow into the person that she is. So the king is going to have a pretty favorable view of Mordecai. And so the narrative tells us that the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken back from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed Mordecai to be in charge of Haman's property. So now Mordecai has control over all of Haman's property. He can use those resources to try to help the people that need help, so to help his nation. But the other key thing that just happened here, and it's really easy to miss, the king has given Mordecai the signet ring. That's the ring that has the royal seal on it. When you send a message out that is sealed with that ring, it's the same as if it was written by the king himself. That's exactly what Haman did when he put that kill order out there. So the thing that's easy to miss is that Haman was the most powerful person in the kingdom other than the king. The sign of that was that ring. Well, now Mordecai has the ring. What's that mean? Mordecai is now the most powerful person in the kingdom except the king himself. Now, he still has limitations, right? That even though he has the ability to write orders in the name of the king, he still cannot pull that kill order back. Because the rules are, once it's out there, it has to stay out there. But he's allowed to write any order he wants other than trying to cancel that order. So what does he do? It says, he wrote a decree, and we call it the king's decree because it's written in the name of the king. The king's decree gave the Jews in every city authority to unite to defend their lives. Now, you read that, and you're like, well, duh. Like, why weren't they doing that anyway? Well, if you're in a conquered nation, right, so your nation's been conquered by an empire, and that empire wants to maintain control, what's one of the first things an empire is going to look for to see if there's unrest and someone trying to turn on them. Is the people uniting and coming together? So under the empire, any nation trying to unite and kind of arm themselves would have been outlawed, because the assumption is you're going to try to turn on the empire or at least try to break away. So you did not have the right, normally, to unite to defend yourselves. But now with this order, the Jews have that right. So now they're permitted to organize. And this is really important, right? Because as opposed to people having to defend themselves, and each family or person trying to kind of survive on their own, they're able to come together. Again, they're able to have the power of other people being in their lives, a community coming together. And so when this order goes out that they're allowed to unite and defend themselves, something really remarkable happens. It says, in every province and city, wherever the king's decree arrived, the Jews rejoiced, and they had a great celebration and declared a public festival and a holiday. So notice there's something interesting here, is that when they got the right to unite and come together, they weren't complaining like, oh, I've lost my individual freedoms. They're like, no, we're better together, right? That they weren't so angry to lose their individualism, they embraced the fact that they come together. You know, and you know, I kind of mentioned this idea because, you know, in the Western world, we tend to often look at the idea of working together as something that takes away from me. But the reality is we are stronger together, particularly when we have a common cause, right? In this case, right, that the Jews and the empire had a common cause to defend themselves, right? But if, as one family in Christ, we have a common cause to serve the people around us, to lift people up, to share the gift that we've received with others. And it could be such a tendency to kind of, you know, come in for an hour, you know, hear a great message, of course, right? And that's a joke. For those who are new, that's a joke, right? Yeah, an okay message. And then head out and just live your week. No, we're called as the family of Christ to do more than that, to be a community connected with a common cause of bringing hope and light into a world that struggles, of lifting up people who have trouble on their own, and living out a life that looks a lot like the life of Jesus, to bring that light, to be that light, so others will discover that light. That doing that does not take away your individualism. It lifts you up, but we lift each other up as well. And that's certainly how they saw it. And they're celebrating. Now, why are they celebrating? I mean, the battle still lies ahead, right? The battle has not been won. The battle hasn't even been fought yet. What in the world are they celebrating? Progress. They've had a breakthrough. Prior to that order coming out, that decree coming out that Mordecai wrote, there was no hope. Their chances of surviving this were minimal. Now they have a chance. Now they have the opportunity to do the work that they can, to come together as they can. And what they've done is that they have not waited until the final victory to celebrate. They've celebrated an intermediate victory. And how often do we forget to do that? That when we're in a long journey of any sort, whether it's health, whether it's work, whether it's ministry, whether it's family, we're like, well, you know, that good thing happened, but you know, there's still a lot of problems ahead, and you need to focus on those. And we should certainly deal with those, but when something good happens, let's celebrate it. You know, if you've got cancer and they're treating it and you hope the tumor would be gone and it's not gone, but it's smaller, celebrate that. You know, when you have relationship issues and you're trying to struggle through and you'd hope that maybe you could finally live together, you know, live in the same house again, and you're not able to do that, but you know what? You're talking again. Celebrate that. You know, if you're struggling against debt and you've got tons of debt and it's going to take a few years to pay it off, but you know what? You paid off a credit card. That's one less. Celebrate that. When you're working through your ministry, whatever that is, whatever God is calling you to do with your life, you know, maybe you haven't fulfilled everything you've set out to do, but you know, maybe you've just got a bit more support. Another person stepped up to help. Something else came in that you'd hoped for, but you weren't sure how you're going to get. Celebrate those things. See, the reality of life is that all the bad stuff doesn't wait until the end to happen. Where we have struggles throughout our entire lives. But somehow we feel like we should wait until the end to celebrate. But if we wait to the end to celebrate, we miss the significance of all the good things that happen along the way. And we start to forget the good things that have happened. And that makes our journey feel longer. And it makes our journey harder. But if we'll celebrate as we go, it renews us a little bit. It helps us to see the hope that we can actually find. That comes from being willing to celebrate along the way. As you walk it out, celebrate along the way. Now for Esther, Mordecai, and her people, they've kind of now done all they can do, right? That they've got this authority to organize, to defend themselves. They get to work getting ready to do that. They celebrate the fact that they've got that ability. But once they've done all that they can do in terms of getting ready to fight, there's really not much left for them. And do we know if they're going to succeed or not? Well, what we find happens is that once they've done all they can, something else starts to happen. That other people from other nations under the empire join their side, come together to support them. That even some of the nobles step out to support them. And I think this is this idea of kind of embracing our faith and focusing on doing what we can, how these things intersect. That we do all that we can, and we can stay in connection with God, and that we pray a lot, right? That, again, we read His Word, we seek His guidance. And as we do that, this kind of amazing thing starts to happen. This is for a quote from a guy named Basil King. He was a minister in the late 19th century into the early 20th century. He was also a writer. And basically says, be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid. And what that really shows us is that that's kind of how God works sometimes. That when we're in a journey, in a difficult journey, working to get something done, to do something, oftentimes that journey will be difficult and it will be long. And even though you're praying and you're seeking God's guidance, it feels like He's being silent. He's like, He's not there. I keep asking Him. And I don't see Him moving. I don't see Him changing anything. But as we stay in it, and as we work to do the part that we can, suddenly, things show up. That moment comes where God seems to bring it together. He was there the whole time, as I talked about with the clouds, that it seems like He's not there because I can't see Him. Just like on a rainy day, the sun's still there, we just can't see it. That's what the journey is like. The thing to recognize is that our relationship with God is not passive. It's meant to be active. It's meant to be connected. It's how we're built. It's how we're wired. That this idea of just praying for something and hoping you get your results rarely produces much of anything. It's the idea of connecting to God, praying, and then doing the part that you can. That's what produces the results in our lives, is that connection, right? That idea of bringing those things together. A friend of mine used to say, are you praying to Santa Christ? In other words, God, I need a gift. Just send it to me. I don't want to do anything for it. I'll just wait for it to be under the tree tomorrow, sort of thing. Now, there are certain things we can't control, and of course we lean on God for those things. But whatever we're dealing with, have we exhausted all the things that we can do? Because there's a very challenging reality about our relationship with God, is that God is far more interested in who you become than what you do. He's far more interested in who I become than what I do. Now, what we do influences who we become. But we keep focusing on this, I just need to get to that thing, I just need to get to that thing. And what God's focused on is, how does our heart change? How does our mind change? How does our relationship with other people change? How do we change in the way we see the world? How do we change in the way we see other people? God is far more interested in growing us as disciples of Christ than He is in giving us big trophies for getting to a finish line. But the journey still matters. It's this cycle that in trying to do the best we can, of persisting in the silence, embracing the gifts that come along, Walking out the struggle. They're the things that change us. They're the things that grow us. That's what God is trying to do in your life. That's what he's trying to do in my life. That is the journey. And that's where this idea of, again, facts, faith, and focus all kind of come together. That in any situation, we look honestly at our reality, and we make decisions based on that. We lean on our faith, trusting God to do the things we cannot, but focus on doing all that we can. That if we pursue the things we feel called to with a half-hearted effort, expect half-hearted results. But if we lean in as hard as we can and we do the things that we can do, God will enable us to do far more than we can do on our own. And a big part of doing what we can do is staying in the journey. Even when the journey is hard, that willingness to not give up, that willingness to stay in it even when it's hard, that willingness that when you just hope that thing would be this big when you got to this point in your life and it's only this big, whatever that means for you. But you're like, I'm doing what I can. I'm following God's leading in my life as far as I can tell. It's staying in that. It's willing to go through that process. It's when we do that, that we start to see God's movement in our lives. God's waiting for you to move, to do what you can. And then he will move. So what happens with Esther, Mordecai, and their people? Right, this day finally comes. They've done what they can do. God has sent additional forces to strengthen them. And so the big day finally happens. Now remember, it's this kind of strange thing, right? That there's this first order that was written by Haman in the king's name, which allows the people of Israel to be mass executed, basically. But he picked a date way out in the future because he thought that was the most favorable date given to him by the fates. And in that time, a second decree is written in the king's name by Mordecai, which says that, well, you guys can all pull together to defend yourselves. So how does it come out? What happens? Because effectively, what you've got here is a one-day war in the kingdom, right? For kind of one day, there's kind of open war, one side against the other. And the narrative tells us that. So on the planned day, the two decrees of the king were put into effect. So Haman's decree that you're allowed to attack the people of Israel, and Mordecai's decree that says they're allowed to defend themselves. That both comes to play on the same day. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but quite the opposite happened. It was the Jews who overpowered their enemies. So it's Esther, Mordecai, and their people ultimately prevail. Now, the thing that's kind of funny is that as we read that, I'm like, well, that's kind of anticlimactic. I've been waiting 3 weeks to hear what happens. And you're telling me, like, in three verses and in one day, it's all done? But was it three verses in one day? Or was it 10 chapters? Right? What is your journey like? When you when you get your all-clear diagnosis medically, was that one 10-minute visit you got with the doctor, was that the whole thing? Or does it go all the way back to the day of your diagnosis? Or when you start feeling sick. It's a long journey. Oftentimes, things seem to resolve in an instant, but the burnout occurs in the long lead up to that instant. The loss of hope can start to burn out in the lead up of that instant. I mean, imagine what it was like for the people, for Esther, for Mordecai, for all the people of the nation of Israel. That they waited a year. They one day, for all intents and purposes, in the mail, a letter shows up saying that, about 11 months from now, 12 months from now, all your neighbors are going to try to kill you. But make sure you wave when you see them in their store. Right? They would have been horrified. Right? That the people of Israel, the Jewish people, from the moment they saw that decree, and probably virtually every morning they woke up for the next year, they would have been tempted to believe that success was impossible. Think about when Esther had to go speak to the king, knowing that she was more likely than not to be executed for trying this. She had to be tempted to believe that success was impossible. Imagine Esther, if she did all that work to get to the king, to defeat Haman, when she found out that order could not be repealed. She must have been tempted to believe that success was impossible. Just like us, when you're in a dark situation, when I'm in a dark situation, every morning you wake up, one of our first thoughts is tempted to be, success is impossible. But in spite of that, Esther, Mordecai, her people, they never gave up. Right? They stayed connected to God. They did the work that they could do. And they found success. And the thing that's so important about this is that once they found success, again, they didn't just move on. Because once the victory was won, Mordecai put out another suggestion. What Mordecai did is that now that we have the victory, what I want to invite all of you to do is to celebrate and remember. In fact, the Jewish holiday of Purim is actually the celebration of the story of Esther, which is still celebrated by Jews throughout the world today. That each year, people who are Jewish come together on Purim, and what they do is they actually have a party. And they tell the story of Esther. Again, and often little girls will dress up as Esther. And what they do on that day is they celebrate and they remember the bravery of Esther. They celebrate and remember the work of Mordecai. Again, events that happened over 2,500 years ago. They celebrate and remember how the people came together to do what they could do. And they celebrate and remember how the work of God brought the pieces together to do the things that they could not do. And that's the thing that I want us to grab onto here, is that if we've talked so much about getting through difficult times and prevailing in difficult times, no matter how old you are, I would bet that you've got more difficult times ahead. There's your good news for the day, right? But it's reality, right? But here's the other thing. You've had lots of difficult times in your past as well. And you're still here. And you're still kicking. And some of you are really kind of excelling. In fact, for some of us, it's the difficulties in our past that position us to do new things in the future. I mean, that's certainly my story. That the culmination of me being here is the many, 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 many mistakes that I made along the way that changed the direction of my life. That God moves in those things. And a key part of kind of being able to get through that next difficulty is celebrating and remember the last time you got through, the last time you prevailed. That if we just move on from one difficulty to the next, that's exhausting. But when we get through a difficult time and we take the time to celebrate that we got to the other side of that thing, whatever it is, it helps us to remember when God showed up for me that time, when I thought there was no way to the other side, God showed up for me. And so the next time we find ourselves in a difficult situation and we're tempted to believe that success is impossible, you know, A, we're going to do all that we can, but we're going to stay connected to God. And we're going to remember that the God who brought us through last time and the time before that and the time before that is the same God that can bring us through this time. Right? That's what we want to do, is that it's by being willing to celebrate and remember that propels us forward to do what we can do with our lives. And as if you're someone who puts your faith in Christ, you've got lots to celebrate and remember. Right? Because the story of Esther is a great model of what Jesus has done for us. If we think about it, I mean, what is the story of Esther? There was a group of people who were destined for death. And this girl, Esther, this girl who had basically nothing, rises up, become royalty, become queen. And she intercedes on behalf of all those people. And by interceding on behalf of all those people, she saves their lives. Well, what has Jesus done for us? Jesus was the ultimate royalty who had everything. And what did he do? He gave it all up, become someone who had almost nothing. And there were a group of people, because of sin, were headed to death. And Jesus, who never sinned, decided to intercede on our behalf. And through that has given us life. And that is something to celebrate in our lives, that we've been given this incredible gift, this incredible opportunity to go forward with life and remember what we've been given. And one of the greatest ways to celebrate and remember what we've been given is to live it out. to serve the people around you, to serve one another in this church, but serve people in your life, people around this church, to do the hard work of being someone who shows up when others don't, someone who provides support when others don't. That if you want to preach the gospel, that's the best way to preach the gospel, is to live it out by caring for others, supporting others. And in that, share the hope that you have, the reason for your hope, so that person can have the opportunity to celebrate and remember. That's what we are called to do as the family of Christ. That's the gift that we have been given. That's the gift that we are called to share.